Lowdown Chronicles. Meet your maker.
The latest podcast episode for Lowdown Magazine called Meet the Makers. And I guess both of us, some of the early Lowdown days from London, represented Lowdown since 1995 together. How did it start for you, Willem?
Yeah, Meet the Makers, Lowdown Magazine. I'm not even sure if I'm in issue one of Lowdown. I'm not even sure. But we met in a club in Hoxton, Metalheads, covering an assignment, covering the growth of hip-hop, drum and bass, jungle, Do you know what it was? It was that acceleration of culture that was happening in London at the time. And Gertz, you came to London as a young man, as a journalist with your ambitions, you know, to make it in the world. And obviously the number one thing to talk about was the Metalheads.
It's amazing. It was like when I was at uni, lived in student halls in Bestwick Street. I remember it vividly when I walked first in there, and it was a whole different universe. And especially that club Blue Note was just incredible, wasn't it? I mean, the energy, the music itself, everything was, for me, changed a lot of things, really.
Yeah, it's I think the club itself had its own sort of unique character in terms of you'd walk in, you'd queue up, you'd walk in, there was a bar, there was an old man in the back cooking Jamaican food. There was downstairs, there was a Function One sound system, there was the heat, the sweat, and then the piping in the room that would always sort of condense water, and it would be just
and
dripping.
The weed smoke everywhere. Blazing everywhere. I mean, it was like a whole universe in its own, really, completely different.
It was a utopia, wasn't it? The way London, sort of all those industries that were in East London had just disappeared, and what remained was just sound systems and parties and vibes and where culture's made, you know? And obviously Lowdown's been sort of about the culture, you know, sort of always tapping in to different cultures. Like, I mean, where were we? New York, late 90s, we end up in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Broadway. That elevator to Raucous's offices, which was decorated in Keith Haring's artwork. You know, you went down the road to see Ramsey and Phil Frost. I was hanging out with Mos Def and Talib Kweli.
Yeah, and interesting the way it went. When we continued to journey to New York, but let's stay in London. I mean, one of the first people both of us met, and I filmed for Super Low 8. You did obviously many pictures of him, and I did various interviews. Is Goldie, the guy who ran Metalheads, Mr. Drum and Bass. Really, talk about him. Interesting character, and always fascinating to hang out with him, wasn't it?
Yeah. Always an inspiration. He's a leader. He's an inspiration in respects to art as well as music. Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, he's a visionary that sort of enabled myself as a generation to come in and capture his genius and his club and his gathering and his team, you know, because that was ultimately what it was. Is like he was the head coach, and he gathered his forces, Chemistry and Storm, you know, running up at the front, you know, Groove Rider, sort of the bass driven god, and Fabio, and you know, all the kids at the back, Bailey, Inc, you know, and so on. So it was nice to document that and be a part of that experience, and also to sort of remind ourselves that with regards to that culture, that it was all about the teams, and all the teams played together. You know, Hype had their teams. We hung out with Danny Breaks, Renegade Hardware.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, Valve.
Interesting. Little camps.
Yeah.
All these different little camps all over, not just in London. Yeah. You know, the Bristol connection. Crowds, you know, Crust.
Yeah.
DJ Die, Ronnie Size, I mean, incredible as well.
Very,
I mean, it was fascinating and I absolutely loved it as well. What about two guys for me that we spent a bit of time with and that I absolutely thought were incredible? Lemon D and Dillinger, Vive Sound System.
Yes.
Very interesting aspect, the way Dillinger built the sound system. Let's talk about that a bit.
I mean, obviously, it's again, visionary, you know, sort of being the second generation or the generation after sound system, you know, sound men, you know, the sort of bass culture that was introduced to this country by Jamaica when they shipped over their sound systems and their valve amplifiers and they started building these superstructures to bass, you know, and we've sort of followed that in this country particularly. With drum and bass and Dillinger and Valve being the next generation down, you know, bringing it and causing problems with it, you know?
Mental. The system they had. I was in their warehouse somewhere in Greenwich and the way when they had it stuck up there. I mean, what an incredible setup they really had. And the other important people, I guess, in that time, the Bristol connection. Let's talk about Ronnie Size and Crust, because Crust, you took some incredible pictures which have been published in Lowdown as well, which, you know, we've interviewed and met him a few times. And he was always someone who had a bit of a different view on things and was an amazing guy in the drum bass.
Absolutely. Again, coming in from the mild West, you know what I mean? He was like bringing in that flavour. And that's something I miss about England, you know, the sort of the regionalism of it all, where different parts of London, different parts of the country, different parts of anywhere would have their own flavour. They'll have their own food, their own dress code, their own music, their own sound system and their own way of thinking about it. But we'd still all come together and compete in this dance hall and engage with it. And so it was nice to have these different mindsets and these different people producing music that essentially became the soundtrack to the 90s. You know, like when you think about how, I mean, I'd love to sort of rescore some of the Super Low 8 films that we did and rescore them with like vintage sounds, you know, like put new music underneath it. Not to take anything away from its original form, but now we can look back on the past and go, okay, this stood out. These are the key moments. Crust, In Crust We Trust is a great story. It's a great way of contextualizing, you know, what it's all about, telling these stories through camera, through words and pictures, and tag teaming with yourself, Gertz, you know, like...
Yeah, I have done that, you know, four tech we've done. There's
J-Lo, there's so much more.
Stories.
I'm not even sure this podcast can cover it.
No, that's a good one, though. Let's talk about that, because that's one of my favorite moments I've had with you.
I'm going to save that one for part two. I'm not going to talk about J-Lo now. We're going to hold back on J-Lo. We're going to hold back on Mariah.
We wait for that one now, because we stay in London for a moment. Because one of the other areas, I guess, and we've done a few things together there as well for Lowdown, a few stories together for Lowdown, was the UK hip hop scene, because that for me was fascinating, because it's such a deep, you know, Roots Maneuver, Task Force, again, all these different crews, you know, it's a big scene that, back in the day as well.
I mean, as a junglist, really, I sort of thought about the hip hop guys and thought they were a little bit bummy, you know, they didn't really have the right clothes, they smelt bad, you know. I mean, I love Skinny Man, but my man, he was loud, you know what I mean? He'd be on the bus with his dog and the whole bus would smell like weed and be like, Skinny Man, like, respect to you, but fucking hell, yeah, you mans are just out here just wiling.
I'll tell you a funny story. One of the funny stories, one of the most low budget videos, but I actually really ended up well, was when I did a video with Skinny Man and the Mutt Family, and it was called Thugs Are Us, and I took the boys paintballing in some woods, like somewhere outside of London, and I'm not shitting you, we took a bus with all that lot, went to the forest somewhere, and while we were sort of setting up some cameras, you could see a cloud of weed, because literally whatever, how many 30 youths from Camden came out, and it was such an incredible experience. And I love those boys, I have to say. Task Force, Chester P, Hackenbush and Farmer Giles, a lot of respect for those two guys. Beautiful music, still make amazing music. Farmer's Psycho Assassin, I think it's called. Those were interesting boys as well, definitely.
No, I mean, I appreciate you guys bringing me in on the whole UK hip hop thing, because also let's not forget Lowdown HQ for a while was based in the heartland of, you know, Mud Family territory, so it couldn't be helped. You know, I came to sort of respect them and their steez and their values and their penmanship. But you know, like I said, they really didn't sort of, in the fashion game though, they were just weak, you know, so we really couldn't hang out like that, you know, I hate to say it, but to this day I still wear Prada and Pringle socks, so Yeah, so that's and that, you know, that's to the point off cam off podcast that we're talking about. Like, it's hard for me to talk about UK hip hop because I really feel like I didn't give it my all, you know, the way I did to drum and bass or the way I did for jungle.
Yeah, no, for me it was interesting because when I came from Germany, I was into the early German hip hop, you know, absolute beginner, the Hamburg school. So for me, that UK hip hop was really interesting, and I really liked some of it and still do as well. I mean, Roots Maneuver is timeless.
Well, I think that's part of the biggest
Rodney P, Rhythm Killer. Oh. I mean, you know, my guy, I did quite a few music videos for him later, and was incredible because that's what I ended up doing, getting into the music video side and doing quite a lot of videos for you know, domestic signs. Legacy video, first ever video Estelle was in, Tempa, Wildflower, female MCs bringing it to the fore really early on. And it's my friend DJ Skits, a good mate of mine, who again is, I thought, an incredible music producer who I got to work with. And I thought it's a really strong UK hip hop scene, definitely there.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said about European hip hop and the culture of hip hop in Europe, which was ultimately the underpinning of my relationship with Lowdown, is because, you know, like coming to Berlin in the early 90s, you know, seeing the wall fall come down firsthand and then meeting this new generation of young Berliners coming through and hanging with them, not really being able to speak English too great, but ultimately the language of hip hop was our universal communion. Like, we could literally communicate through, you know, I could communicate with Thomas through lyrics and songs. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was a form of understanding that was underpinning all of this. And so it was hip-hop culture that really brought us together. And within that, I always argued that the fifth element of hip-hop was always skate. You know, like, the four elements being, you know, MCing, DJing, b-boying, you know, dancing and all that. And so to see what happened in Europe and then to see the blowback when you guys came over to England and started to engage in our culture and making videos for all these hip hop heads, it was like kind of like the bigger picture is how it all sits in Europe, you know, how it sits in France and Italy and all that shit. And maybe that's the bigger story that hasn't been told, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, all that.
What about the journey to New York? Because we did you know, a couple of bits there as well, and you were definitely one of the early ones who to work with Raucous Records.
Yeah.
Mos Def, Talib Kweli. Talk about that connection.
Yeah, they were good. They were good kids. You know, I was couriering dats for Trouble and Vinyl. You know, so making, you know, keeping the connection alive where these Americans wanted to come in and have a piece of this drum and bass pie. So we sort of started that negotiation, and I was like the linchpin in that because I was spending so much time in New York, working with the box, doing the television stuff, you know, just having a good time and really getting to know these guys, getting out for dinner, seeing their vision and working with that vision, you know, because that's really what it comes down to. I think many times throughout our lives, it's really about the visionaries. It's really about those linchpins between the big money and the creativity.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a real struggle for me. I had a meeting yesterday with this agency about a campaign, and I just lost my shit with this agency. I was going, you fucking cunts, like, what the fuck? Like, what the fuck? How can you talk about humans like that? How fucking inhuman can you be, you pussy clock fucks? Like, fuck out of here. And it just made me realize that if we don't have people who understand what's needed and know what needs to happen, that shit doesn't happen. And how many times have we seen that through, you know, your relationship with especially athletes? You know what I mean? Like, what you've been experiencing working with so many athletes, from the skate kids all the way through to snowboarding and so on. It still requires leadership. There's heroes in this game.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, always. Mm-hmm. No, for sure. And a couple of other interesting stories I would like to talk about, because they were, for me, moments I will never forget in my life. One of them was when we met Tricky and these East London gangsters, in which was the old Astoria, legendary venue in London, Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was a special day, wasn't it? Because Tricky itself was incredible. I remember vividly how he found this little doll outside Tottenham, outside the Astoria, and picked it up. And you've got amazing pictures of this, with, you know, which have been in London, obviously, as well. That was a mad day, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was a great day, a great bit of organisation, a bit random too, because you didn't really know what you were going to expect. And when you walk down the stairs, all you see is a bunch of old boys just like having a chat and having a cup of tea, you know, having a cigarette and that. And you go, "Oh, boys, yeah, how's it going?" And yeah, you sort of respect your elders, so I gave them their dap. But it's only until they sort of start telling their stories that you're like, oh, you mans are like
bloody
murderers.
Murderers. I mean, we talked to people there who had killed people,
which was
a crazy thing. It's the first time I sat in an interview where I talked to someone who openly talked about killing people.
I was
a bit like, okay, interesting. And they were quite funny as well. Both of us, I used to have dreadlocks back then. You and me, the two dreads, the white and the black dread, were coming in there, way younger, obviously, than most of them.
Yeah.
But Tricky was good. I mean, he was interesting as well. He's always done his own thing, and I always sort of found him an interesting character.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about this conversation as well is, like, meet the makers. It's always, we're coming back to these visionaries, these kind of individuals that had a thought. And, you know, he comes from a family of gangsters, and he wanted to put gangsters on, like, let them tell their story. And I think it's interesting that British gangsters choose to use the media as their way of retiring. They retire in public face. Yeah.
Dave Courtney being the prime example. I mean, he made a career out of all his, you know, films and books and whatever, but he was the most accessible as well, which was, again, what I experienced with him later on when together with Paulo Carrera, who by now, sadly enough, is dead, one of my early mentors in the film industry, the stuff I did with him, with these gangsters, after we first met them, because we ended up filming Dave Courtney, Bruce Reynolds, the mastermind of the Great Train Robbery, and Howard Marks, and spending time with those three was an experience, I mean, which was incredible. And, you know, they were their makers, their own makers in their own right, really, definitely visionaries as well. I mean, the Great Train Robbery, Bruce Reynolds, he had his studio, his son had his studio just around the corner from where we are right now. Yeah. And interesting family as well, very fascinating people.
We do our best to get the stories out there, but there's so much of it that we don't even tell. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's the things that happen off camera and off story. And part of us wants to sort of tell those stories, but ultimately it comes down to, Howard Marks, man. Tell me about him, though. What was your takeaway from Howard Marks?
Howard Marks, I'll tell you the funniest thing. The first thing we filmed with him, the first shot we ever made with him, was him coming out of the customs in Heathrow. Paolo and me sort of smuggled the camera in almost and stood, you know, proper undercover with this small camera and filmed Howard Marks coming out of customs, which was quite a nice little touch. And it made it into the film as well. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, he was... I was quite shocked. We went to a bed. He lived in a bedsit in Shepherd's Bush.
Mm.
It's quite sort of a little bit run down, really. I mean, he was a lovely guy, really nice guy. And but I was a bit sort of, you know, him living there. But he, you know, obviously had properties and lived in Spain as well. And he was a fascinating character. He was very intelligent. Had, you know, a story after the next to tell, and was good to work with as well. I mean, we filmed some great stuff with him. Yeah. And then we took him to went to Ladbroke Grove and filmed him in a park there. Did like a sort of outdoor interview, run around with him, obviously smoked weed with him, which, you know, was you know, after sort of I was done, you know, I had a joint with Howard Marks,
of course.
You know, and it was an experience. I mean, it was a day again. I never forget those days. I mean, that's the thing. Thanks to Lowdown Magazine and, you know, any other people who are interested in my stories, we've met interesting people, really.
And going out of our way to sort of find these interesting people and put them on. And I've always admired your passion for it, because you'd always put me on to sort of like new voices in the game. I'm like, wow, okay, you know, someone that you really care about and whose story you really care about, who's, again, they you know, man, one of my favourite ones, I think it was like from Lowdown issue one, was that we had to go to Boots to do a shoot of this kid who happened to be the DJ who did the mixtape on the cover. And it's like the sense of the underdog, you know, the sense of like, there's still heroes in the rough, you know what I mean? They're just coming up, you know, and we were always that. We're just coming up. We're making the best of everything we've got, all the connections we have, and putting them down.
I mean, we and Lowdown as well. Lowdown as a magazine was always early. Huh? It was there, you know, found the people, and a year later they would be really big, you know, or whatever. You know, I mean, look at, you know, in the arts, on the art side of things, I found it amazing, you know, how early, you know, Obey.
Exactly.
Banksy.
Yeah.
All these legends of, you know, they were in Lowdown way before anyone really knew about them, really.
Yeah.
And that's what I liked about Lowdown. You know, they went for the, you know, the upcoming.
Absolutely. The green shoots. And I think that still stands now. I think it's an interesting one, though, because the point about being able to look back is sometimes it's about growth, and it's about how we're in a linear sequence, we're moving forward, and so it's a tough one for me to look back it's really hard. I just have to keep looking forward.
Important, yeah. But looking back quickly, what about the books then? Because you've recently, you know, in terms of legacy project, coming back to where we met, Metalheads, drum and bass.
Exactly.
You've been involved with a couple of book projects. Tell us about those.
Yeah, I think it was years after, moving the photography into the gallery and then the gallery onto paper and doing that for hip hop and doing it quite successfully with Contact High and getting that narrative out there so that, you know, hip hop photography is now in museums in America as it should be. And then thinking about how we then tell our story in this culture war that we're currently in, post Brexit Britain, the narrative that we all dance together under one roof, you know, we all did this. And so Who Say Reload was the photographs, and then I reissued Junglist, or it was reissued with me, which was the actual experience I had in the raves telling my side of the story.
And I loved reading it, and I loved looking at it, because I mean it really encapsulated what it was like. I mean, being at Metalheads, being in all these places, I mean, bloody hell, it was an experience. This is it's undescribable, really, what it was like in those big Metalheads raves.
I mean, the scale. Some raves are bigger than others. I think coming back to Metalheads is just reminding yourself how small it was, how dense it was, and how loud it was, and how hearing a tune by Dillinger for the first time, cut on dub plate, knowing that it came straight out of the studio, and then it being rewound twice by Groove Rider because Goldie's losing his shit, is a beautiful thing. It's
beautiful.
Yeah.
A beautiful thing. Yeah,
you know, to be baptized in bass like that. And I think we've been lucky enough to see its roots and fruits, you know what I mean? Like, to see where it came from.
I remember as well, Sundays, how excited we were. We were in student halls. We lived in Bestwick Street, 10 minutes from the Blue Note. Yeah, we walked, but then, you know, like, because it was a weird time as well. It was Sunday nights from you could go there at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
So we basically, as a student, first year, it was like, we basically, you know, started smoking spliffs in the afternoon and then, you know, had a nice evening out at Metalheads till midnight and raved like mad people.
Exactly.
It's
amazing. And London will be dead on a Sunday because shops will be shut, you know, and that part of town was not seen as the best part of town, you know. It was in that weird calm where, as students coming in, it was at a time when London was at its most empty, so you're kind of walking around these really dead streets of former industries and just walking into this, you could hear the hum in the distance, and then you'd walk past the cab office, go up the stairs,
and it was so different. I mean, if you think about it, you know, 1995, what Shoreditch was like then. And I remembered vividly people telling us, don't go past, Hackney Road, Old Street, further down into Hackney. You know, don't go further east, basically.
Yeah,
because it was Murder Mile. Yeah. It was definitely different to what it's like now. You know?
No, I don't know. I think East London is as shit as it always was, but it's just got more hipsters in it, so that kind of like balances it out.
And it's still rough around the edges, but it's so different now. So different. I mean, I lived in Bethnal Green for a long time.
Oh my God,
like Shoreditch Station now, that was cracked. Horse there. It was like a proper rundown, nasty little stretch, really. And now it's, you know, hipster-centric.
No, and I do admire that, because even coming up in photography, like where I started out, you'd look at books by Don McCullen, and there'd be pictures of Shoreditch, and it would be this living hell, this bomb site, where, you know, like the Bronx, like that's how you'd visualize it. And yeah, you'd see these photographs, and my first missions as a kid was to go around to these areas like Shoreditch and take pictures. And yeah, it was a proper dusty shithole, like bombed out like car parks and shit. Like,
but that's what I like. That's what I always liked about your pictures as well. Yeah. You always documented certain areas in a good way as well. Brixton, obviously, but East London early on as well. And you found an aesthetic always with your photography that reflects a certain area as well, which I always love about your photography.
Yeah, I think that's the underpinning of it all, is like there's a certain journalism in that kind of photography. And I think that's where the crossover is between us, is that respect of journalistic values, you know, and
very true. That's why our work, we worked always really well together. We always had a very similar vision, really, at the end of the day, how we want to portray certain things, whether it's a story where you took the pictures, I write, it's a video. Videos, we've done videos together.
Exactly.
I mean, come on, we've done some, a lot of big things. I mean, I don't know how long we've talked now, but perhaps the video, because that for me changed a lot in my life, the TAS video,
which you
brought me onto, and we sort of co-directed it.
And then
that's when Nick, Dizzy's manager, contacted me because he sort of liked the way we handled ourselves.
Exactly.
And then I ended up doing a couple of Dizzy videos and working with Dizzy a lot. So that's a whole other chat, really. But I don't know.
I mean, that in itself is a beautiful time, because that is being able to draw some inspiration from Marok, particularly as an art dictator, and step into the field and go, right, Taz, I'm going to take care of your shit, like all of it. Like from your videos down to your EPK, down to your artwork, the whole lot is going to be taken care of by me, and you just turn up. And so when he wanted to do a video, Cowboy Girls, I think.
It was,
Cardinal
Official, we did once as well.
Official.
Yeah, but the TAS video, Cowboy Girls,
it was a simple thing. It was basically find a great location, find some great cast, and just, rap with all your friends. You know, like, come on. Like, it's your first video.
Keep it
simple. Not too pressured. But the point is that we, as Gert says, we handled ourselves. Because at the end of the day, everything was so precious back then. And we just came in with, like, a more looser, just, like, laissez-faire style, where it's like, if you allow the conditions to happen, certainly for me in video, if you allow certain conditions to happen, it doesn't matter where you point the camera, it's always going to be sick. And that's why, in terms of co-directing, I could literally step back and Gertz will step forward. There's certain scenes that Gertz wanted. I'm like, well, I couldn't care less about those scenes. I only care about these scenes. And then with the edit, the beautiful thing is it goes to Jeremy's cousin. Jeremy's cousin's in the edit and says to me, Eddie, when I do edits, no one sits in with me. You just get the final piece. Goodbye. I'm like, all right, mate. Yeah, done. All right. Sweet. That was it. End result, end product, banger.
Definitely a banger. And Eddie, what about those music videos we did with who was the other one? Cardinal Official, the Canadian boy. He was around at one of them as well.
Yeah, that was part of Taz's EPK, or part of the remix of the Cowboys thing single. And having his voice lent to this whole thing was a beautiful thing. Giving him a cold because we asked him to ride a bicycle in the rain. I just thought, welcome to England, bro. That's how we live.
That was quite a fun little afternoon.
Exactly. And that was it. It's just like fun little afternoons. You know, we just, their jaunts, their moments, they're sort of capturing a point in time, and then it all comes together on paper, you know. We did good. I keep wanting to look forward, and it's hard, really, because this is a podcast. This is about the past. This is about what Tony Soprano would say the lowest form of conversation is, which is when you say, remember when. But
let's talk about J-Lo, though, let's talk about J-Lo.
Now, J-Lo's still alive. We can't talk about J-Lo.
That, for me, was one of my most spontaneous but very exciting little missions, because you called me literally an hour before and you're like, mate, can you come and help me? You need to interview J-Lo because people are, you're not here, basically.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, hey, why not? So that was funny. Talk about that day with J-Lo.
Yeah, it's, basically, J-Lo's in town. Come on, Gertz. Do you want to sniff J-Lo? I pick up the phone. Go, come on, Gertz, you want to sniff J-Lo? And Gertz is like, I want to sniff J-Lo. Let's go sniff J-Lo. Anyway, so so I'll tell you where, tell you when you arrive. We take care of business. It's
that's what we do, and that was for me was obviously quite exciting because it's J-Lo, and I was a young man, and
exactly.
You phoned me and asked me an hour before you wanted to be J-Lo. I was like, of course I will, and it was great because I did prep. I bought a Arena magazine, read everything about her, did my interview based on that, killed it with her, and she was lovely. I thought she was nice. She was very professional. There was some tech issues as well. It was a bit of a chaotic shoot for the box. It was, wasn't it? And they didn't quite.
I think we lost our crew, I think, ultimately, so we had to sort of switch around roles where I was on camera or maybe on sound and you were on the interview, and roles were switched around, but ultimately it was fine. It was a great box talk, huge
it's
numbers
great, yeah.
And it just allowed us to sort of, again, we had a style like Dutch cameras, like no angles are correct, just boom. Recently you pulled up the RZA thing again. It's just like these wonderful moments where it's like, again, the RZA's here, do you want to come and roll? Like, yeah, of course. And then the conversation starts, because I think it was always a case of, I may have one job going in one direction for one crew, but I can, there's always leeway to call. I know Gertz is there. Gertz always wants the story. So it's like, come on, just come and do this. You're in town. Let's get that story. And then we have a lowdown version. So always within our publishing circle, there's like multiple versions of the same story, but the lowdown version is always the realest version.
Very true. And that leads to what you just mentioned, RZA as well, because obviously we've done a lot of stuff together with Wu-Tang Clan. Let's talk about them. I think it's a good way to end, because that kind of, you know, away from the raucous crew in New York, Wu-Tang Clan have been other artists we both have worked with quite a lot. And RZA, let's talk about him. Box Dog, for me, again, a visionary, a maker.
Yeah.
I always admired his work. I always, you know, from the early days when I listened to Wu-Tang Clan, I thought he's definitely one of the interesting ones, one of the outstanding ones. I mean, what a man. And to have met him, for me, I felt, you know, blessed, really, because, again, he was professional. He did funny little takes with us for the Box Dog, you know. Yeah. He was up for different things. And let's talk about the RZA a bit, because...
Yeah, the RZA was a beautiful day. I think there were several things going on at the time. But yeah, ultimately we had a box talk with him. And you get the call again. Just let's do a version. We've got time. And because I sort of knew some of his background team and everything else, so we knew things were loose. You know, like in some cases when we were hanging out with the RZA or we're hanging out with some artists, they're not like the biggest artists of that time. You could still sit in the pub with them and have a drink and chat and do cool shit. So that was always a beautiful thing. We did that. The RZA again with his vision, you know, like, yo, let's just do the interview in the bathtub. Yeah, all right, cool, yeah, all right.
I love that. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't believe the footage. Yeah. I found some real gems, old footage from, like, you know, the early days. And that was definitely one of the funny ones. It was in the bathtub, literally.
Yeah.
The RZA liked the
bathtub. Yeah, it was a good look. It looked great on camera and it translated well, you know, into lowdown.
And he was really nice. I have to say, he was nice, he was funny, he was professional, it was great. The joy. To work with RZA, and so was Method Man as well. I mean, I've met him a couple of times, and again, interesting man and a visionary as well. And it's always fascinating to you know, see people from a completely different cultural background like that. And I mean, we went out there, filmed them in Staten Island. I went to work with them once in Staten Island, and
amazing
in there as well. And it was incredible, obviously. The whole.
What did Dave Chappelle say about Staten Island? Like, Staten Island's like shit, apart from the Wu-Tang Clan. Yeah, and what's Staten Island like?
Shit, apart from the Wu-Tang Clan. Well, it's a bit like that.
Yeah.
I guess we've talked quite a lot now, Eddie. There's so much more.
But you know what? I've got to be honest with you. We've still got more time to go. And I think the reason why we do have more time to go is because I really want to sort of talk about Yoko. Because I remember the thing about the drum and bass scene that really touched me was how many women were involved in it. And I've forgotten to appreciate that.
Yeah.
How we just took it for granted. How Yoko was part of... Clayton, Mark, the Trouble and Vinyl crew, the Renegade Hardware, the dawn of, you know, obviously Metalheads were such an inspiration to us that we continued on that ride through drum and bass all the way through, probably till the, you know, and then came off the journey and moved on. But the point was that these women were there to support us. They were there to support the teams, and they were there to make sure that there was peace among the teams. Like, there was no real rivalry. Everyone would compete. To this day now, you know, Andy C, the Ram team, you can kind of appreciate how it's supported people. And I always really respected the fact that Lowdown had a skate team for a minute. And now how we felt like a team, like, and we'd go out there and roll out in the car, all of us had bags of weed, you know. And that team culture and that team feeling is really, man, it's needed, you know, like it's to see you, Gertz, we don't see each other enough, you know what I mean? Like, we're actually seeing each other to do a podcast, not actually to have a pint, do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of odd that, and obviously that's just the nature of work and hustles and grinds. But
yeah, interesting what you said about the women in drum and bass, because it's always, what was it, I think it was Sarah.
Yes.
She, Metalheads, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Every one of these crews had the ladies in the background who were running things, mainly. That's quite, you know, often not looked at, and I find that out, very interesting.
And that was the strength of drum and bass in jungle, was that there were ladies in those hard techno sounds, but there's women in there.
Running a lot of things
on the dance floor too.
Of course.
So the rhythms aren't, you know,
and chemistry and storm as DJs.
Oh my God, yes, of course. They led the way. As A&R and visionaries too in their own right, you know.
Yeah.
As a team, as a duo. So it's always been a wonderful wonderful part of the experience, really.
And that's what I liked about the UK hip hop scene as well. That's why Domestic Science for me, because Estelle, I mean, she was bad temper.
Yeah.
That she was from Birmingham, Nottingham, from Nottingham.
That's right.
She was incredible. Yeah. And for me, I really enjoyed, you know, when we did a video with them as well. It was like I did the Skits Domestic Science video with them, and it was an interesting experience where they all were up for doing different things. Yeah. You know, they were not the cliched videos.
Yeah.
We filmed her and the place I lived just around the corner, 22nd floor of Peregrine House.
Yeah.
It was for 1 year I lived in that.
I think you were there. Yeah, of course.
We were in 22nd floor.
From the window, it was the full moon at night.
Incredible place, really. Yeah. And we did one part of the Domestic Science video up on the gangway with Winston Witter, someone to mention
of
as
course,
well, an old
friend
of ours
of
who was shooting that video or helping on the shoot with the video. That is, you know, also the women in hip hop were always there in England, which I thought is, you know, interesting. And there's now, look, Little Sims.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a long legacy, really, of good female hip hop artists in this country. Right?
Yeah, no, that 100 on that. And I have to sort of admit that years later, when I did come to listen to UK hip hop, certainly through your sort of inspiration, ironically, but it's sort of the penmanship, you know, the lyricism, you know, the actual writing, core values at their core, like. It's I think the strength was in the written word. It was always for me, I realized it was the accent that was the barrier, but the actual technicality was flawless.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, so many of them and such different styles, but a lot of real wordsmiths and like, you know, I mean, Roots Maneuver, look at his lyrics.
Oh my God.
And, you know, he's again someone we met a couple of times and I've known for a while, really. Yeah. And I thought, again, very, very visionary artist, the real maker, obviously, you know, left his imprint on the UK hip-hop scene.
Yeah, certainly one of the most human of the makers. And I think certainly the UK hip-hop artists, you see the mental health experience played out in real life. You know, you do see Roots Maneuver walking around Brixton Market, sometimes sort of struggling, you know.
He was troubled for a
while. And really, in UK hip-hop, it's something that's talked about. You know, it's a concept that's not, you know, certainly Farmer, certainly not Farmer, but certainly that, those boys, sometimes when they speak, they're open and honest about that. And I kind of feel like that's a growing thing, isn't it? It's a growing appreciation, certainly as many of us, if we came off the skate parks that we grew up on and seen homies come and homies go, and, you know, some of us accelerate, some of us just, you know, drift off into the distance and take normal jobs and become civilians, and some of us become fucking samurai gangsters, which brings me back to Tricky. Right, that's what struck me about these guys. They struck me like they were like samurai. They were like samurai, like old, and they were just basically coming out of, like, they must come from a long line of warriors who just basically moved into crime. They're businessmen whose business was crime.
Definitely,
and I mean, they were matter of fact and cold blooded about it.
Yeah, I know they were. You know, some of them were a bit scary, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean,
Dave Courtney pulled out a gun.
Matt Frankie Fraser was one of them.
Yeah.
Tony Lambriano.
Yeah.
There's a couple of others whose name I can't remember. And then was obviously Dave Courtney, who was the most then already the most accessible. Who was like, you know, quite mate. Funny thing is, I mean, we filmed with him again as well, and he's always, I bumped into him on the street. I'm good with Dave Courtney, which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah, because he's
still is, you know. Wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him, really.
He's still a legend. So let's talk about Arsenal, because how can we not talk about Gertz and not talk about your relationship to Arsenal, Gertz? I need to
Arsenal. They're doing a bit better again, I tell you that.
So you were there for the Wenger years.
I was there from the early days to our friend Phil Tucker.
Again, connections. That was all about this life in Lowdown. You know?
Who's a big Lowdown fan as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's got a few of your pictures, I think, as well. And Arsenal, mate. I mean, that's, you know, I grew up, so to speak, in London, here, not far from here, in the heart of Islington.
Exactly.
And that's Arsenal homeland. Yeah. So for me, there was no question who I'm going to support when I first moved here. And we're talking 1994.
Exactly.
So I've supported the Arsenal since 95, really. Yeah. And I used to go there a lot with Phil Tucker, and it was incredible. But it was another, it's almost like in a different way, like what I experienced at Metalheads.
Yes.
I also experienced at Highbury.
Yes.
And it
yes.
was special. It was English football. Right there. I mean, I love my football anyway. Werder Bremen is my team in Germany. But it was a different and very special experience. And the Arsenal is, you know, they're doing better. And you got to be positive.
It's just a question of time. I remember the negativity that came to Wenger's way at the end. And I felt people expected more.
Yeah, of course. He should have left 3 years. He should have left.
Yeah.
when he won the FA Cup against Chelsea. I was there with Phil Tucker and his son.
That was the highest.
And that was the right point, and he didn't. They all kind of, you know, want to hang on, get more success, but it went downhill a bit already anyway. Yeah, yeah. And he overstayed it a little bit, but he's a legend, and I love Arsene Wenger. And he's the Wenger years now. Oh, man, he's like, you can't take that away from him. Yeah. He's like, literally, he changed not just the culture at Arsenal, but the culture in English football.
Yes.
Because he brought a whole different approach to football, a more scientific approach, the way they eat, the preparation. And he's a legend, but he's still overstayed, and he should have fucking left three years earlier.
And I think in times to come, like making the choices he made, especially with Thierry Henry, was... made some great football moments.
Ah, yeah, of course. I mean, not choices. Just Bergkamp.
That's what I was expecting. Come on.
Robert Pires.
Do you know what I mean?
It was like the Invincibles after that, you know, with Lehmann, the German, in goal. I mean, this has been an absolute, you know, incredible teams for years, and they still have a really, really good team now. Yeah. And I think, you know, trust the process is all I'm saying. Mikel Arteta, trust the process, and we'll be there. And we're sixth now, and we're coming up, and it's going to be a good year for Arsenal. And, yeah, so that's also my sort of London legacy, which, you know, with Phil Tucker, someone you know by this way.
Exactly. Good shout out to Phil. Yeah.
Phil Tucker.
To the Tucker fam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good people.
Exactly. So. And the momentum's been kept. And I think it's an interesting way to forge a friendship and a working relationship in the sort of baptism of the metalheads. You know what I mean? Like, this is where it begins, you know. And I remember you mans came over with some German skunk, which us London mans weren't really on at the time. And mine's were blown that evening, you know what I mean? And that's the core, that's the nucleus of the relationship,
which leads me to talk to you about one last thing, which is our good friend Mark in Devon, Mau, really interesting artist I've known for over 25 years, does his own thing, used to work with Banksy quite a lot, I think Banksy a little bit inspired by him at times as well, and talk about, you know, the projects you did with him, because you did some nice kind of your prints with his artwork on it, some nice project with him, really.
Yeah, I think Mau Mau was again another part of the connection, part of the team, you know, part of the Lowdown family. It's certainly on this island side of things. And, you know, the Devonshire cream, this the glory he brought from the coast, and that mindset and his jar consciousness was a kind of a beautiful breath of fresh air that we kind of don't really expect, but England has tucked away in Cornwall. You know, as you've kind of experienced England is kind of, there's other Englands that just don't tell you about. You know what I mean? And he comes from that other England. And
very much like,
and he brought that beauty with him. And so to then contextualize that by, you know, that fluidity between him adding his artwork to my photography, or me adding my photography to his book, or we teaming up to do the filming for his... It's all about the art, really, and the beauty of that
art. It didn't work for me personally. I was so happy when I linked you two boys and what came out of it. Exactly. I was quite proud, because I could see how you two fit together.
Shared,
and it was beautiful. Vision. I mean, what beautiful, you know, pictures you created there.
Exactly, and unique, you know, one-off pieces. We created three pieces for a show in, 2002, the Brixton Graphic Show. Again, something that the Lowdown family were part of, but... We created these three pieces, and one of them was stolen. The Method Man's piece was stolen. A bunch of utes rocked up into the gallery, took it off the wall, and walked out, never to be seen again.
Which is such a shame, really.
Which is such a shame. But, I mean, you know, what the greatest honor of having your work stolen by my mans on road. You know what I mean? The road mans must have this.
It's a one of one. I can see that. I still want to kick his ass with it.
Just bring it back when you finish with it, you know? So that was a part and parcel of the bigger picture and part and parcel of the bigger legacy. And that's the thing I've got to shout out to Morocco and the rest of the team for, is the way you mans handled shows back in the day, the way you mans did the art thing, and how that has to come back again, because we need to sort of return with that. And
always. I mean, it's incredible what they've really built, and that it's still there as well. I mean, I'm so proud of Maroc and the whole Lowdown crew. They were still there running it still. And it's always been great, you know, to do projects with them. And we've been on that Lowdown journey for 25 years, talked about some of it for a while now.
Yeah.
And I guess, Eddie, we will do some more Lowdown projects at any time, really.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're always on the card. So I think, really, I want to put it out there now. I think Maroc shouted me from time to time, going, next time I do a book, I've got to shout him. And I'm like, yeah, bro, next time I do a book, I've got to work with you. But we've never sort of found that sort of that sort of meeting point as the right sort of publisher or anything, but that's the vision really. And I think that said, it will happen.